I welcome your counsel and questions and suggestions tonight, as in every lecture, and consider it a privilege to be here. You know, church history or history is not dull. It's exciting, but church historians are often dull. And that's pathetic. And they kill the subject and kill the interest, and it's a plague. But, you know, teaching all those courses and having to take them all with one person is sort of like that professor who you only have so much to say. And when I was in my doctoral studies, and one fall, the professor came in and he saw about 10 of us in the seminar. He'd had us all before. He just looked and said, "Well, gentlemen, what'll we call it this time?" But I said I would share something tonight, at least yet, about J.J. Thiessen, and let me take a few minutes for that. J.J. Thiessen had a tremendous sense of humor, and that makes living a lot easier. And in a time like today, I don't see how one can get along without that. He and his wife, Tina, were asked in 1951 to take a trip to South America to visit the refugees and the new settlements there. And I was with MCC there. And so they corresponded with me, and I made the arrangements for their tour there and flew to Brazil to meet them and show them around the colonies in Brazil and discuss things with them, then took them on to Uruguay and took the overnight boat to Buenos Aires and in Argentina. And there he developed a severe eye infection, and I had to take him to a doctor. And it was pretty late in the evening by the time we got out. And then we went on to Paraguay, and we flew into the Chaco. A couple of us had bought an old plane. We wanted to start an air service to the Chaco. And so we'd bought an old twin-engine plane that didn't run very well. But we had two good pilots, Swedes, that were out for adventure, and they were my pilots, and I was a manager of the airline. And so we thought we were doing all right. And we got to the Chaco okay, and we had a nice time there. And then we started back, then we developed engine trouble. We looked at each other and said, uh-oh. And here was Brother J.J. and Sister Tina, and they were getting a little scared. We had to make an emergency landing, and that isn't easy in a Chaco with all the bush. But we finally found a strip on a farm in Estancia, a large ranch, and we landed there and were able to fix what was wrong enough that we thought we could make it to Asuncion. And so we said, okay, now we want to get back on. Mrs. Thiessen said, "I'm not getting on that plane anymore." Well, he said, "No, but Tina," and so he talked to her. "Nee, Yash, ek goed an ich nab. I'm not going on to that plane." Well, finally, he said, we got to go. It's going to get late. We got to go. And so he finally said, "Na, Tina, dat haft me ouder ze jou schrikkelijk goed te gaan met die op water zijn." "Tina, I've enjoyed myself with you all these years. Goodbye." "I'm not going to spend the rest of my life in this bush here. I'm getting out of here." And so he got on a plane, and she got on a plane too. So we flew to Asuncion, and then we went to Volendam Colony, and there I got sick. And if Dr. George Epp were here, he could help me out with the story. But we had a German medical student there who the best thing he could do was take out appendixes. And sure enough, I got real sick, and he diagnosed me as needing to have my appendix removed. And so next morning, I went into that little makeshift hospital, and I won't go into the details, but it was only local anesthesia. I do have guts. I saw them. Now, this German student, he was kind of a daredevil, and he wore a holster with two pistols, always, also while operating. And so he wanted to treat me extra special, so after the operation, they carried me over to his little house, not that far away, instead of putting me in the hospital with the others. And then he said maybe because some Paraguayans had been there, and here was an Americano, they said, and he presumably was rich, and he thought maybe they're going to cause you some trouble, and so he pulled one of those pistols out and stuck it under my pillow. Well, I said, I don't need that thing. I couldn't see anything anyway. I'm too sick to shoot anybody anyway. I wouldn't. Well, he just didn't listen. So it was there. I didn't care. I wasn't feeling very well. And a while later, Brother J.J. and Mrs. Thiessen came to visit me and came close to the bed. And all of a sudden she said, Yash. And she headed for the door. And out she went. You see, part of that gun was sticking out from under my pillow and pointing right at her. Well, they then went on back to Canada, and eventually I got better and went about my work. And then I began to hear rumors from Canada that Brother J.J. was traveling over Canada and reporting on South America, and was saying, you know that MCC director Dick there? He sleeps with a revolver under his pillow. And so I began getting letters. We thought you were non-resistant. And all this kind of stuff. Well, so then we came back, and we were supposed to report at the Canadian conference, and I was supposed to report. And so Brother J.J. was up on a platform, naturally. He was chairman of the conference. And so I gave my Paraguay report. But before I did that, I thought, here is my chance to get even with this dear brother. And so I began to tell him about the landing and how he almost left his wife in a Chaco and this kind of stuff. And then I told him about Buenos Aires, how when his eye infection had gotten so bad, I said, we've got to go see a doctor. And so we took him to a doctor, and by the time we came out, it was pretty well dark, and the streets were not that well lit. And the doctor had bandaged up one of his eyes completely, the sore eye, and he couldn't see too well, I guess, with the other, I don't know. And so I was trying to steer him, but there was a lot of traffic on the sidewalk, and all at once I heard him say, Natina, come doch. Well, Tina, come. And she wouldn't. And then we looked, and he had another woman by the hand. Was trying to drag her home. And so I thought we were even after that. I told that on the conference floor. And so he was a man with a great sense of humor, and taught me a lot about learning to laugh at yourself and not take life too seriously and to enjoy it. What is the Anabaptist vision that we talk about? Well, I'm sure many of us know, we've worked at it, we can discuss it in great length. Let me review some of the things just quickly to get it before us. 40 years ago, this year, Harold Bender spelled out the Anabaptist vision in 3 points in an address that he gave to the American Society of Church History. Discipleship, love, and voluntarism, or voluntarism. The latter, of course, implied that you do not have infant baptism, because infants, when they're baptized, do not have voluntary choice. So this meant believers' baptism. Discipleship, love, and voluntary choice of membership in a church and faith. And that became the norm. That is the Anabaptist vision that is most often talked about, because that was the first formulation of it, and he called it the Anabaptist vision. Some years later, Don Dernbaugh, who teaches at Bethany Seminary, Church of the Brethren Seminary near Chicago, took in a very creative way, the vision that Luther had in his best days for what the church could really be like if he had his way the way he wanted it. And it's strange. And remember that these are Luther's points, how he wanted to create the church. And Dernbaugh uses them to describe the Believer's Church. They're in his book, The Believer's Church. A, Luther said, we want only those who seriously want to be Christian and who want to profess the gospel with hand and mouth. This is Luther. The opposite of a Volkskirche, a people's church. Secondly, or B, they would sign their names in a book and meet alone in a house for prayer and worship. Separation. C, they would perform Christian works, discipleship. D, they would reprove, correct, and excommunicate church discipline. And remember, this is Luther. E, they would willingly share with the poor and help them. This is mutual aid. F, they would have a brief and neat order for baptism. He was talking about believers' baptism. And G, they would center everything in word, prayer, and love. This is pages 32 and 33 in Dernbaugh, The Believer's Church. Center everything in word, prayer, and love. And I think this is an excellent grid of what the Believer's Church, the Anabaptist vision, really also constitutes. Except this time it's Luther spelling it out, what he would have liked to have done, if he could have. John Yoder has a fourfold grid which he spelled out some time ago, two for inside and two for outside. For the inside the church, you have free choice, freedom, free choice. And you have Matthew 18, that is admonition, Matthew 18, 15 to 18. If you know that your brother has sinned, go and talk to him alone and so on. Outside the church, Yoder says, you would have mission and non-resistance and a reconciling stance of people to people and people to God. Inside, free choice and Matthew 18. Outside, mission and non-resistance and a reconciling stance. I think these are all crucial definitions of the Anabaptist vision. What Bender said, what Dernbaugh quotes Luther as saying, what Yoder says. Some of these, or quite a few of these, actually, I would argue, are fruits rather than roots. And Smucker, I think, would agree with me, or I with him, Don Smucker, when he said that really, in response to Bender's discipleship motif, Smucker said, that is derived. That's not primary, that's secondary. And what is it derived from? Smucker said, from Anabaptist Biblicism. I would add to that another grid, and that is something I believe fairly deeply and that I think has been neglected too much. That in much of early Anabaptism, there was a very strong emphasis upon conversion, the new birth. Menno Simons wrote extensively about the new birth. He wrote a treatise called The New Birth, but he wrote in other places too about the new birth as being the beginning and the point without which you can't really proceed in holiness. Dirk Phillips wrote Von Geistlicher Restitution, on the spiritual restitution. Again, a treatise on a new birth. Harold Bender, when he was writing his biography of Konrad Grebel, looked in vain for a something like this. Something like Calvin and Luther reported briefly that they had had a conversion experience. He couldn't find it in Grebel. And finally he said he must have had a conversion experience because he led a changed life. To which I would reply, amen, because that's what conversion means, to turn around and start in a new direction. But we can't really find a specific place where Grebel talks about it at all. At least Bender couldn't, and I haven't been able to either. Now, if these are some of the lotzi, some of the grid points of what the Anabaptist vision is all about, then we need to take these and without looking back only, we should not be a backward-looking but a forward-looking people. But we should take these as landmarks and look for their roots in the New Testament and then feel free to apply them to learnings in every age, including our own age. That is how we can span the 2,000 years to the early church. Many traditions, like the Anglican and Catholic tradition, they span those 2,000 years with the liturgy, with the creeds, with the Mass, and other liturgical practices that they have. We don't have that. How do you get back to the early church? Most Mennonites simply jump from the early church of 16th century to the present. And that is too neat and too quick. We need to have a more solid bridge than that. And I think this can do it if we work back in this way, from the roots with the New Testament orientation to the present situation, and then apply it to us personally, ecclesially, sociologically, and economically in every way. Now, the second thing I would like to say, if this is a brief summary of what we talk about when we speak of the Anabaptist vision, I want to say a few things about the fact that Anabaptism is not Mennonitism of the 1980s. We sometimes hyphenate Anabaptist Mennonite, and that's okay, so long as we are aware of the fact that 16th century Anabaptism is not Mennonitism of the 80s. There are many, many differences. Now, there is a great deal of legitimizing today of what we want very dearly by taking the Anabaptist name or blanket and spreading it over it and saying this is Anabaptist. Well, it may or may not be, and we ought to be very careful before we invoke the name of Anabaptism all the time for the things we do in order to have it blessed. The danger of doing this, of waving the Anabaptist flag, is on the one hand that we so idealize that 16th century vision that we hear the angels sing. Then we look for a church, an Anabaptist type church, and we go to the Mennonite church around the corner and we say, my foot, that's supposed to be the Anabaptist vision? No way. That isn't what I've been reading and hearing. I'm not going to join those fellas. I know all their weaknesses. I know what they do during the week. I'm not going to join them. That's one danger. We idealize it and we lift it up way there. And we can't find a single church that will meet our needs. And we're sort of sidelined eventually. Or, on the other side, we denigrate or push down Mennonitism so completely and our heritage that we see nothing but apostasy everywhere. We see nothing but failure, and we become very critical of the church. And this is a misreading of history and misuse of tradition. But let me submit six samples of pivotal, course-changing events in the history of Mennonitism that helped to move them from the 16th century kind of phenomenon or vision to where many of us are today. And of course, this varies from place to place. I submit, first of all, that persecution had a profound impact upon the Anabaptists and continuing upon Mennonitism, and that it may well have shaped our identity perception of who we really are right to the present time. In some sense, Mennonites, while they may well feel superior to many other people in many ways, they are still also struggling with inferiority complexes collectively in cultural contexts and other situations. And they try to compensate in many ways. And I suspect that persecution of 16th century and how it is filtered down to our own day can well influence our image of ourselves individually and together to this day. A second phenomenon or sample that I consider pivotal for our pilgrimage is the frontier phenomenon among us. The pioneering ethos that we go into the wilderness alone, whether it was the Vistula Delta around Danzig, whether it was the Ukraine, whether it was the Chaco. And we have a frontier mentality, a pioneer mentality. We can do it. There's a great deal of vigor and strength and enthusiasm and cooperation very often to overcome almost insurmountable obstacles like the Green Hell in Chaco, so-called. But this has also affected us, a pioneering spirit. And it has lent a kind of rugged individualism which sometimes stands us in good stead and sometimes doesn't. Because if a 16th century Anabaptist was willing to die for their faith, his or her faith, and we read that and absorb that into our own psyche, our own psyche, we will also understand why they were willing to break fellowship with each other. Two Anabaptists were in prison in Antwerp. They were to be executed next day. They were brought a supper, a better meal than they'd ever had. And first one was given a meal, and so he sat down and started eating. Then they brought the other one and said, "Here's yours, now you can join him." And then he said, "Him? I don't even want to be in the same heaven with him." They were both Anabaptists, and they both died the following day for their faith. And they couldn't eat their last meal together. They felt so strongly about the faith that they were willing to break fellowship and bridges for the sake of the faith. If you're willing to die for your faith, you're also willing to break fellowship for the faith, is one of the readings I take from this historical kind of pioneering frontier spirit. A third sampling of a pivotal event is the loss of missionary concern. For centuries, where they fled into the mountains of Switzerland, they fled to the uninhabited areas of the Ukraine or the Delta, Vistula Delta or the Chaco, to get away. Sanford Yoder years ago wrote a book called For Conscience Sake, that Mennonites of all Mennonite migrations can be understood for conscience sake. I once read a paper before an historical society on that theme, and I investigated the migrations of the 1870s. And I discovered that that conscience included the need for land for their sons. It included all kinds of things that we today would hardly classify as conscience. But it was for conscience sake. That's why they always had to migrate. Well, I think we need to take that with a grain of salt. There were many other ingredients that were involved. But in any case, it was flight, and it was a loss of mission concern. So when the Mennonites left Russia, One of those who stayed wrote, "Thank God that they went. They were just a wet blanket on everything we were trying to do." This was the 1870s migration. "They will probably make good farmers in Manitoba and in Kansas and Nebraska, and we will be better off in Russia. Salt is needed here too, and we're supposed to be the salt of the earth, and we will be salt in Russia," he wrote. But was it for conscience sake, you know? The Canadian government promised them everything they asked for, sealed with an official seal of the crown. They came to Manitoba to investigate it in 1872-3, and the delegation of 12. And many of them went south and explored Kansas, Minnesota, the Dakotas, and Nebraska, Oklahoma. And while they were supposedly emigrating for non-resistance, and they had a sure guarantee of it here, the states, because the government in Washington couldn't handle it because it was the jurisdiction of the state, the states didn't have exemption. And yet 10,000 settled in the states and only 8,000 in Canada. And one of them said, "I won't settle in Manitoba because there's too much snow in winter and too many mosquitoes in summer." Well, that was enough reason to blow the conscience, right? So you see, I'm a little cynical, or skeptical at least, about that putting too much into conscience. A fourth pivotal event or experience in Mennonitism, in the shift from Anabaptism to Mennonitism, was the fear or even rejection of education, higher education in any case, for many, many generations. Je geleerter, je verkeerter. The more educated, the more perverted. And this persisted for a long time. And when the General Conference was beginning to emerge, it didn't emerge until 1860, but when Oberholzer was having all his trouble with that group in eastern Pennsylvania in a Franconia conference, and finally left that conference in 1847, shortly before that he was elected as minister. And, you know, they never told or arranged in advance whose turn it was to preach. When he came to church, they told him, "John, today you will preach." Well, he knew that sooner or later his turn would come, and so he had thought about it and studied the scripture some, and he must have given a fairly decent sermon. And after he was done, he heard several people say, "Das war eine gelehrte Predigt." That was a learned sermon. That was bad. That was bad. Which meant it didn't come spontaneously. He was quenching the spirit. He didn't rely on the scripture, which I think he did, really, in that sermon. But Mennonites have been afraid of education. Now, that has changed. But over the years, this has been true. And we still find it in some Mennonite groups and Amish groups, that this is still there, and you need to study those groups to discover where many of us were earlier. Fifth, there was a loss of eschatological urgency. Mennonites began to settle down. The Lord isn't returning right away. We don't have to make our decisions in the light of the soon return. We're going to be around for a while, so we might as well enjoy it and make the best of this world. And they began to settle down. This had a profound impact. And sixth, the near total acculturation or almost assimilation in Northern Europe and all of Europe, Western Europe, and in North America today, where there is increasing not only acculturation but assimilation. And this, of course, has both positive and negative possibilities with it. So I take this as a commentary on the fact of the road of transition from 16th century to the present. And when you talk about Anabaptism-Mennonitism, You need to keep these kinds of considerations and others that you might want to add in mind as you talk about it. Well then, in light of all this, what kind of idealism are we talking about, and how realizable is it? Well, we're not talking about a Platonic idealism in the sense as being the opposite of realism. Maybe Hegel was a little closer with his thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, but maybe even that doesn't begin to capture the idealism, but maybe it's said best this way, that it's the not yet, taking the long view. The idealist is not necessarily one who has his or her head in the clouds, a dreamer, otherworldly, but more nearly has a grasp of what is and what can be. Now, some would argue that's no longer idealism. That's getting on into the pragmatics of it. But I submit this can also be idealism. We have a great vision, and we're a long ways from it, but we strive towards it. All religions tend to be idealistic. That is, there is more than the human condition, is what it would mean. And Christianity is very idealistic. That is, it is against naturalism, against materialism as final end or meaning of life. But we cannot ignore the natural and the material. What we can do is to use it and transcend it and transform it. And the denominational story is often the story of how different traditions have coped with this transformation process. I submit, then, under my fourth paragraph, that 16th century Anabaptism was very idealistic, but also very this-worldly. To wit, in their authority, they appealed to the New Testament over against the tradition of nearly 1,500 years. And one is reminded there of that kind of folly of Luther, who, when he had written his theses and was arguing with his superiors, he was arguing with Cajetan, the papal nuncio sent from Rome, said, "So, you Luther, the monk," and Germany was then on the what they called the dirty outskirts of the West, the wilderness. "So you Luther, from your monastery, you think that we have all been wrong, and all us learned people and all our fathers have been wrong for nearly 1,500 years. And you alone are right now." Well, he said, "It troubles me too. But if God once spoke through Balaam's ass, he can also speak through me." It's that kind of holy boldness that the Anabaptists had. If he can speak through an ass, he can also speak through me. I think this is something of what Paul meant. The gospel of the cross is foolishness to many people. Or take as an illustration that the Anabaptists were advocating the end of the Corpus Christianum, the state and church being one homogenized society. This was sedition and heresy combined, because it undercut the state, the foundations of the state, which was religion, and it was destroying religion because it was separating it from the state. And so it was both sedition and heresy, two grounds for burning anyone. And yet, in their advocacy of believers' baptism, they were doing just that. And don't think they weren't revolutionary. Don't, and we'll get to the revolutionary theme yet. Don't think that they weren't revolutionary. They were so revolutionary that they burnt thousands of them. Why would they burn innocent people if they were innocent, if they weren't a threat to anybody? Don't kid yourself. They were such a threat that the only way they could cope with them was to kill them. The only good commie is a dead one. That's what they were saying. The only good Anabaptist is a dead one. Let's kill him. Non-resistance. So completely unrealistic. How can you run a state by being non-resistant? This doesn't go. How can we resist the Turk? He wants to take over Europe. Several times almost did. It was touch and go that we would all have grown up Muslim. But they couldn't understand that there was another way, a way of love. And who knows what would have happened if Luther had been faithful to his conviction that violence really is wrong. And Luther said, with a sword you will get nowhere. You've got to do it with a word. But when the chips were down, he said, smite, stab, slay, kill. He who kills a peasant does God a favor. That was the existential moment for Luther. But the Anabaptists insisted that that's not the way. The way of the cross is the way. That's the way Christ overcame evil. He didn't grab the cross by the short end and make a sword out of it. He had himself nailed to the cross and said, yes, I could ask my Father and he would send legions of angels, but I don't need them because that's not the way to overcome evil. You know, I'm not sure in this nuclear age, and you notice that I'm commuting in my presentation both this morning and now from 16th century to 20th, because many of you have pastoral concerns. I hope all of you have personal and pastoral concerns. Sometimes when I read the Mennonite press in Canada, not for that matter in the States, but I'm thinking now of Russian Mennonites who know communism well, either directly through experience or through what their parents or grandparents have suffered and told them. Most of my family is in Russia. They've perished long ago. We have very few relatives in Canada. Sometimes it seems to me that the Mennonites in Canada, if they could vote, they would vote for Ronald Reagan and to deploy the missiles in Europe. And I'm reminded of this man in Canada who once told me, when we were talking about this issue, who said, I am completely non-resistant. I'm completely non-resistant, but if it goes against the Russian, I'll saddle my horse and ride. There doesn't seem to be another way. The only language the communists understand is power. And thank God for Reagan and the neighbor to the south. I hear a lot of that language. Are we or are we not non-resistant? And what does that mean? For them, it meant death, very often. What does it mean today? We'll talk more about this today, but also tomorrow, in our discussion of non-resistance and Gelassenheit. Now, in its own way, Mennonites are also still idealistic, though we accommodate at many points, and the vision of a believer's church, I think, is still alive among us and growing, despite these problem areas that we have. And that, I think, I can understand and empathize with. My fifth paragraph, then, the Christian and idealism means that the Christian is concerned for change. He conceptualizes, or she conceptualizes, the ought, and then works from the is to the ought with all power available to them. At its best, this is what idealism leads us to do. And by what methodology can this be achieved? There are many different ways. On March 24, 1980, Archbishop Oscar Romero of El Salvador was shot dead while he was standing behind the altar saying Mass in San Salvador by a man who fired through the open front door of the church. Romero had been speaking out on behalf of the poor, speaking for justice, pleading for justice. He was not a revolutionary in the sense of toting a gun. He always told them not to be violent, to be patient, to pray, but he admonished everybody to seek justice and to love mercy. And these death squads were driving around at night and rounding up people and killing them right and left. And then they shot him. He was too much of a threat for him. But he pleaded nonviolence. Years earlier, in 1966, a young man in Colombia from a very rich family, a man by the name of Camilo Torres Restrepo, studied for the priesthood and became very much depressed over the lot of the poor. He tried through his connections in high places, and he was a member of a very high class family, he tried to move society towards change, agricultural change, to give more land to the poor and to give jobs and to help the poor. Finally, he gave up. There's no use. A few families are running this country, and the only way is revolution. And he bought himself a gun and went into the mountains and joined the guerrillas. And the army went after him, eventually found him, and shot him dead. That was another option. Only violence will do it. Talking won't do it. We've talked long enough. We've tried to help long enough. We'll force it. This whole ship is rotten. It's got to sink in order that a new order may arise. And increasingly, because of the present policies, people are saying this in Nicaragua and all over Central America, the same kind of thing. In Brazil, we have Dom Helder Câmara in Recife. The walls of his small room are full of bullet holes where people have taken pot shots through his windows to try and get him. But the witness of that old man has been over the years very, very fantastic. And nearly a year ago, when I first saw the film of Gandhi as it was produced and shown, I was reminded again how nonviolence did win out. And in Canadian history, one could argue, nonviolence also won out. And if the hotheads down south had waited a little longer, they wouldn't have had to have that glorious revolution that everybody talks about in the 1770s. And they could have had independence, and it would have come. It came in Canada. So how do we work for justice, and what does idealism mean? One question keeps bothering me. Should an idealist who has a great vision even ask the question about success or relevance? So what good does it do if I don't pay my taxes? What? They just take the money out of my bank account. So what good? What difference does it make? Does it make a difference or doesn't it? Do we ask or correlate our methodology with faithfulness, or do we simply say we're called to be faithful and this is the best we understand how? The rest is up to our Lord. It seems to me that this is getting pretty close to what the Anabaptist vision was all about. And here and there, I think especially in third world contexts, this is happening. You know, a friend of mine told me day before yesterday, when I was on my way here and was in Nebraska, and he said, what are you going to do in Winnipeg? And so I began saying a few things. Well, he said, none of us can be idealists because we have everything we really need and want, and it would be very dangerous for us to dream great big dreams about change and all those things. We are so content with what we have, we don't need any idealism. We don't want it. We aren't capable of being idealistic, he said. See, Jay, you can't talk about idealism. No Mennonites can be idealistic in North America. They're realists. Where it affects them, that's where it counts. He's a man I respect a great deal. I don't quite agree with him, but it made me think. So my sixth point then is my sixth paragraph, 16th century Anabaptist idealism and our idealism today. Where do we come out at in the light of what I've been saying? Well, they had economic sharing. They followed Acts 4, literally, for a while. At least a good many of them did. But we, of course, know better because that was only meant for the early church and not for us. And, of course, we are biblicists. We take the Bible very seriously. But when were you last at a foot washing service, or what does John 13 mean? And there are many other samples one could give. We take the Bible very seriously, selectively. So there are two strands, it seems to me. The one is the work ethic that the sectarian configuration of our heritage has bequeathed us with, the black and white world, sectarianism or image, where in the Netherlands they drained the swamps, they went on around the coast to Hamburg, went on to Danzig in the Vistula Delta. Who wanted the Vistula Delta at that time? Nobody. And the Mennonites drained the swamps, and they made it bloom, and so productive that everybody got jealous. And they had to leave. And they went to Russia, to the desert, to the steppes. Nobody wanted that. Catherine's armies had chased out the Turks and some others that were there, the Cossacks. And so the Mennonites made themselves at home. And pretty soon, again, it bloomed and blossomed and became so fruitful that everybody became jealous. Not only Makhnov, but many others became jealous of the Mennonites because the Mennonites were so rich. The others were so poor. The Mennonites tended to say, well, why don't they work? You go to Paraguay then. Eventually you're displaced and you go to Paraguay. It's a green hell. Nobody wants to live there. But the Mennonites are there only a few years, and Paraguay and Bolivia go to war against each other. Because suddenly Bolivia realizes that, hey, this could be valuable real estate. That belongs to us. Paraguay says, no way, that's our land. You had the Chaco War. And subsequently, by our standards, the Mennonites and the Chaco are relatively poor, most of them. But the Paraguayan standards, many of them are quite well-to-do, very well-to-do. And envy is increased again. And even in North America, it's true. I wonder what would happen in Paraguay if and when Stroessner dies, Alfredo Stroessner, the president, who is probably the closest friend of the Mennonites in high places there. He goes and eats chicken and zwieback and borscht with them and goes hunting with them and so on. They're on a first-name basis with him. When he passes from the scene, and if the Blancos, the white party, should succeed in getting back into Paraguay, I wonder what would happen, whether we'd have a replay of the Ukraine under Makhnov or what. I'm not sure. All I know is that envy is very, very thick. And it is even in North America, because of the work ethic that we all have. I want to speak to that tomorrow morning in my discussion. But I identify this as one model of how we are working at our idealism, and we then give as best we can out of our surplus to the needy, both of our lives we volunteer and of our goods, our young people in service. Sometimes I think that our giving, say to MCC, is a kind of surrogate compensation to reassure people that maybe we don't believe in fighting, but we're good citizens anyway. Just look at all the things we're doing. And the Canadian government prefers to do its relief work abroad through MCC rather than any other agency. I've been on the MCC executive for enough years to know. And our big problem was always to tell the Canadian government, we can't handle that much money that you want to give us. We can only handle so much. You want to give us too much. They wanted, when I was on it, they wanted us to start great big projects in Colombia and all over. And we simply didn't have the resources for it. But they trusted us implicitly, and I think still do. So that's one way of working. And it's a legitimate way of working. Another way of working is to go the route of the Dutch Mennonites, who became thoroughly acculturated. I'll speak of this in the fourth lecture on the arts, and began to develop such clout that when the government in Prussia wasn't treating the Mennonites right, the Dutch Mennonites spoke to their government and their banks, and because the Dutch Mennonites controlled the banks, really, the Prussian government was told, you will get no more loans from the Netherlands until you treat the Mennonites better. Didn't take long. And they did. And then the loans came again. Or the Swiss were treating the Mennonites so abominably as slaves, as galley slaves, into the 18th century, till finally the Dutch intervened. And they sent, as a Dutch ambassador, a Mennonite, to Bern, and they sent other representatives and said, you had better treat these Mennonites better, or we're going to break off relations with you, diplomatic relations with Bern. Well, Bern's response was to say to the Dutch, well, then you can have them and load them onto boats and ship them down the Rhine. And the first boatload that came was, they had armed guards. And when they came into the Netherlands, the Dutch said, what do we have here? Slaves? We don't believe in slavery in the Netherlands. They promptly told the guards to get rid of their guns and get out of there. Told all the Mennonites, you're free, you can do what you want, where you want to go. Some of them promptly turned around, went back to Switzerland to be arrested again and put in jail. But some went on to the Netherlands and settled in Friesland. And so you still have some Swiss names in the Dutch Mennonite communities because of that. Well, this is another way of helping to bring about change, to realize the vision by working so effectively in society that you really have clout. The government listens to you, members in the cabinet even, and so on. You can actually influence what happens. So these are alternate ways, I think, in which Mennonites have coped with the problem of idealism, having the vision realized, working for a better social order, for a better society. Another way is the way of the intentional community. We can't change this society, but what we can do is create little islands of sanity in this crazy world and bring as many people into it as possible as long as we have time before the nuclear bombs fly. And that is another real option. And that, again, reminds us of 16th century, where they were always building these conventicles and inviting people in. Their missionary thrust early was this: come out of that wicked society and join us. Here's a new community. That was really the only option, social option, many people had. And it was really quite an option that they had. Well, then, when we think of this church world dualism, this, I suppose, is another option. We will have nothing to do with this world. We will try as much as possible to be non-conformed, according to Article 4 of Schleitheim, the black and white sectarian world. And part of this was, I was reminded of again when one of the recent delegations of Baptists and Mennonites from Russia were here, and in Elkhart, one of the Baptists said, they were glad that the Mennonites were finally, in Russia, were finally beginning to understand that non-resistance is not a religious issue, but a political issue for the government to decide. And the Baptists had long seen this, and now the Mennonites are beginning to understand that this actually is a political issue, and leaving it to the government. And the sooner all Mennonites realize that, the better it will be. This is a complete internalizing, or pietistically, inwardly orienting one's faith, but one can understand it in that kind of context, why that would happen. It's compromise. Mennonites have thought usually compromise to be a bad word. I submit that it doesn't have to be, that it can be a very good word, and that Romans 12 calls us not to be conformed to this world, but to be transformed. And that can be part of what we might call compromise. Seventh and finally, are there then any signs of the kingdom? I'm sure you could list many. They may be as small as a man's hand on the horizon. They may be larger. Signs of the kingdom all around us in the Mennonite world. 26 congregations were received into conference at Bethlehem. Isn't that fantastic? 26 congregations were received at Bethlehem. That's really something. I think it really is. And many of them were non-Germanic kind of congregations, Chinese and other. Many of them were from Canada. And they were received into conference. I think this is a sign of the kingdom. Something is happening. People are being won to the faith and to Christ. There is, secondly, a great concern for spiritual growth among many. This is manifest in retreats, in the marriage enrichment seminars that are being held, in the Bible study groups that are forming all over, and in many other ways. There is a new longing for deeper, going deeper in the spirit. Vertiefung, going deeper. There is also a new social concern. I think only of the native rights struggle here in Canada. And I think of the VORP program, Victor Offender Reconciliation Program, which is operative in Elkhart and I think here and many other places, where there's a mediating role taking place. And when a crime is committed, Mennonites are called upon to mediate. And they have even mediated some cases of rape, where they eventually, after a long process, are able to confront the victim with the perpetrator of the crime and work at restitution and, as much as possible, reconciliation and compensation and adjustment. There is great concern, I think, for peace among us. And that's another sign of the coming of the kingdom. Years ago, I walked a little taller when I read the brief that D.P. Newfield and others had written and submitted in Ottawa to the Canadian government, not for once in behalf of rights or privileges for Mennonites, but speaking for everyone and the freedom of conscience that everyone ought to have in Canada to choose, not just Mennonites as a so-called peace church. I walked a little straighter that day when I read that. I guess I was a little proud. When I think of the MCC global activities, the Central America activity in the Middle East and Africa, the young people, the middle-aged who are volunteering their services and giving their lives, I'm humbled and gratified. These are signs of the kingdom. When people are, without any compensation, willing to give their time and their energy and their skills for the work of the kingdom, that is a sign that the kingdom is already here. That is, where Christ is truly Lord, that's the kingdom. And that is taking place. Or when I think of financial giving to our institutions, to our mission boards, to our conferences, and how that is increasing every year, and though we may not meet our budgets always, the budgets are always going higher, but so is our giving always going up. And the increase in enrollment in many of our schools, including right here, these are signs of the kingdom. People are looking for answers, are searching for the will of God. I see that as a sign of the kingdom.